My name's Mark Stephen Meadows. To my left is Justin Hall.
Hi.
To Justin's left is Ben Cerveni.
Hello.
And that's Susan Wu.
Hello.
So we are here to talk today about virtual humans and whether or not virtual humans are really things that are coming up in the future, about non-player characters. Sorry?
I think his mic is on.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Just kidding.
All right. And I guess what I'd like to do is for each of us to take a few minutes to talk about what we're doing, where, you know, kind of how we got here. For myself, I think that in many ways it started the year that I met Justin, which was in 93, and we were both doing very early website implementations. I'd kind of been playing Dungeons & Dragons for a number of years since I was a kid, and I immediately saw a lot of narrative possibilities in the web. And then I worked at a company called Construct, which I helped found, and we were building very early 3D social spaces. I believe we built the first open protocol multi-user environment there using VRML. I went from there to Xerox PARC and started looking at interactive narratives and doing some work on artificial intelligence and Stanford Research Institute. Wrote a couple of books, traveled around, hitchhiked through some war zones, thought a little bit about what it means to have a presence in a virtual space and how now that we're building out all these actual architectural spaces, how do we move characters into those spaces? Now that we've got the places filled, it's not the place that's that interesting, it's actually the people that are there. So did some looking into this. While I was living in Paris, I had a painting studio there, and I was doing a lot of work just doing portraiture, and I decided it'd be kind of fun to make an interactive portrait, and so I realized that was going to take a couple of million bucks to build. Did some design work, started a company, and now we have about 30 people in a company named Headcase, where we're building systems that are not quite artificial intelligence, it's not quite artificial emotion, but it's really more of an ecosystem that balances out emotions and intelligence and the physical representation and the social representation. Really trying to like hit the high road here on what it means to have a creature that's functioning as a human being functions. My long-term goal is still as a portrait artist. I'm basically doing this work so I can get a paintbrush finally. So that's what I'm doing up here. And as I mentioned, Justin, I met in 1993. He was working at Wired at the time. And as kind of the inventor of the blog, I think it's not terribly arguably the case. He and I had a lot of fun nights at Wired, you know, like staying up late after parties, like, you know, doing LSD and pushing big boxes around as we'd clean up and really, you know, having a good time in the San Francisco kind of salad days. And now Justin is at USC, and I'll let him talk.
Yeah, we had fun tossing salads. So my history on the internet is that I think I tried to make I guess I'm thinking about my career in terms of avatars for the benefit of this panel, but I spent about 11 years writing about myself on the internet in order to flesh myself out in virtual space. And I thought if I could sort of over provide information about myself, that would make me real, and that as a writer and someone who wanted to write both about personal subject and non-personal subjects, that having a very substantial presence through text and pictures and, you know, a lack of clothes and a total disclosure would make my online presence more real. It turned out that, I guess, you know, that's kind of hard to do in a long-term basis and in a long-term community relationship and in a sort of long-term career and anything you want to do. If you are exposing everything about yourself, you are setting yourself on a trajectory for Cold Mountain. And if you want to hang out with Han, Sean, that's cool. But I wanted to hang out with Han, Sean, but I also wanted to hang out with other folks. So I'm now working on a project I call Passively Multiplayer Online Games, which is the idea that as you're using the internet, you are creating trails and impressions of who you are. You're leaving comments on people's websites. You might be editing Wikipedia. You're uploading incessantly to Flickr. And you're sort of creating this aura around yourself of who you are, reflected through tiny facets of who you are. Well, what if you could agglomerate those things just by having the computer watch you surf and watch you surf and build a profile of who you are? And this has been very difficult and a lot of fun. So the parts that are difficult briefly is that how do you make a profile of someone as they surf? Well, in order to prototype rapidly, I just said what kind of genres people surf, and I describe someone as a genre, an agglomeration of genres of web surfing, which is sort of limited when you compare it to like astrology or The Sims. Anyway, I'll stop talking now and save that for the panel.
Yeah. Wow. Ben, meanwhile, he and I have kind of been crossing paths for a couple of years and finally got a chance to get to know each other better in the last year or two. He's doing a lot of work in Europe. Ben originally, if I'm not mistaken, worked at Organic and SGI and Frog Design. We kind of set up their experience design lab. And lately he's been looking at how, with the Playground Foundation, interactivity happens, right?
Among other things, yeah. There are a couple of I'm actually coming at this from a variety of angles. There are four or five points, sort of junctures in my career where I've sort of faced the prospect of beginning to understand how people represent themselves online and how people perceive others and the possibility of the perception of others in different contexts has sort of been part of the platforms that I've been trying to engineer. I guess, you know, the first place that I came across these issues is actually in kind of an unlikely social context, which was in the engineering group of an operating system company named B. And we were working a lot at I was in the interaction design group there, and we were talking a little bit about how people were going to, you know, this is an issue that's also coming up now in the design of the One Laptop Per Child project, which is how do you, you know, if you're going to change the nature of computing from document-based computing to relationship-based computing, which is actually kind of where we're headed, you know, how do you represent that, and how do you let people understand the activity of others and the activity of the system in terms of something that's potentially lightly anthropomorphizable in a way that makes sense to people instinctively about activity? And then more recently, probably the place where I learned, you know, sort of the crucible where I learned the most about all of this, the way that people interact with each other in a lightweight social manner online using media, was in this moment where we transitioned from the design of the game Neverending, which is the product that this company, Ludicorp, I was working for, started with, into the project which ended up becoming Flickr. And that was a kind of a crazy moment because it was basically sort of the collapse of a much larger kind of Baroque system for representing relationships between people into a very special and intimate and yet potentially complex way of transmitting information about ourselves to each other just via a single medium, which were pictures. The game Neverending initially was kind of a narrative framework, much like a Moo, that was built around the idea of being able to exchange all sorts of media types and various different constructs of media in a lightweight flash environment. It was a massively multiplayer game, and that sort of the realization that there was this a way that we could reach out to a much broader scope of people if we sort of reduced to the essential the type of interaction that brought kind of representation closer to people in a more tangible way, in ways that they understood, which is not so much to use a system of mechanics and a system of, you know, representation through statistics, but instead just to offer up fragments of experience to each other, and thus, you know, sort of be able to construct a much more kind of sensual or sensory vision of the other through their mediation of their life. But now, more recently, I've been working on two separate projects, one of which is in Amsterdam called the Playground Foundation, which is about researching the transfer of the way that patterns of interaction that have arisen in game design can be transferred to situations like urban computing and collaborative creativity. And all of those, you know, the tools that have arisen in game design to enable these type of, you know, creativity actually really... People carry those modalities with them after they leave, you know, if they've spent a period of their life gaming, or if they spend, you know, a portion of their day gaming, those paradigms don't leave their head. So they're actually really useful in describing the way that we can potentially interact in urban spaces or in online communities. And then the other project that I'm working on right now is visualizing social networks on game consoles. And I think that's going to be a really big kind of, that's kind of a medium in which we're going to begin to express a lot of things that cross between the idea of playfulness and the idea of creativity, and all of that is kind of wrapped up in this idea of representation of self and the representation of other. But I think on sort of the last note, I'm sort of here a little bit as a gadfly to Mark's straw man about the idea of virtual humans. I'm of the camp that actually I'm not that interest in the idea of trying to recreate human behavior computationally. I think there's, you know, this issue of the uncanny valley that we come up against in visual representation is also something that kind of lurks in the behavioral representation of humans. And I feel like one of the things that we're doing as we move into this literacy in game design is that we're beginning to understand other types of self-organizing systems other than humans. Humans, you know, sentient humans happen to be very complex self-organizing systems, but there are other systems that are also self-organizing. And some of those things we're beginning to understand and have relationships with that are not relationships. They're more like relationships you might have with a pet. But they're very productive relationships, and they have what we call autopoiesis, which is the idea that they have self-sustaining. They're separate from yourself. You can tell that they change without your input, and therefore there's a complexity to them that allows you to sustain a relationship over the long term.
Yeah, the autopoetics. I know Ben and I are kind of at, like, in some ways opposite camp, so try to keep the fur not too flying. Psionic battle, exactly. All right, now Susan Wu, by the way, you guys, don't forget these things if you happen to... All right, so Susan is an ex-Quake tourney player and also a jewelry maker. I met Susan originally through her blog, reality.org, and after working at CMO for it was Apache Software Foundation, I think. Now Susan's working at Charles River Ventures, so interesting kind of background.
Yeah, so today I'm a venture capitalist, but I guess the reason why this particular panel topic is interesting to me is rooted in the story of how I accidentally found myself in the technology industry to begin with. As an undergrad, I was a philosophy and cognitive science major, and I've always been and still remain very interested in identity and cognition and how those play out in terms of our relationship with other people and the world around us. And, you know, one of my friends who I worked with at the Unix lab at school pointed me in the direction of text-based MUDs and MOOs as a way of, you know, forming relationships and understanding culture formation online. And so I became really active as a text MUD developer and started playing with social systems that I thought would help facilitate the types of relationships that I thought were interesting. And I've been really involved in online community building and tool systems and social products ever since. And, you know, as Mark mentioned, I've been really involved in the open source community. I've been involved in the security community. I've been an active gamer. And today, as a venture person, I invest in these types of products and businesses that I think are really relevant to helping people form good relationships and helping them expand their idea of who they are and helping them understand their place in the world better. So that's my interest in this topic.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we've got a pretty weird group of folks up here. Everyone's got pretty weird backgrounds, and we all travel a lot with a lot of different perspectives. But I think that the thing that kind of, for me, as I sort of go tee-tug on what this panel is about, I think in a lot of ways it probably has to do with cognition as much as anything. And I'm going to put a question down here that I hope will kind of get us rolling. But I think that cognition is basically a thing that has to do with leash length. And there are some critters that I send out, like agents, and I want them to go out and I want them to collect some, like, you know, information on Justin. And then there are other, and that's usually something with a pretty long leash length, right? I don't know when it's going to come back. Maybe, you know, these are basically, like, a lot of them are just basic prescripted agents. So you can consider them in some cases like readers. But then there's other things that have a very, very tight leash. And this is almost more like it's me. I spent the last couple years in Second Life building a lot, and I have me. It's Pighead Stonecutter in Second Life. And when people see that character, they know that it's me, and my attention, my reputation, my ability to do work there is attached to that very tight-leashed thing. That instantiation of my character is really me. And I think that the length of the leash is a thing that really usually has some kind of a proportional relevance to how much cognition is in something. If it's an avatar and I see another avatar there, I assume that it's going to be pretty cognitive. I assume there's going to be a person behind it. And I guess, Ben, I want to might as well just, you know, throw the punch fast here. I guess that for me, the relationship with a pet feels to me like a, you know, a long leash relationship. It's not something that's very cognitive. The pets that I have, I have some sense of identity with them. I can interact with them, but I don't find that I have a very generally as interesting a relationship as I have with human beings. I do say generally there intentionally. And so I wonder, I mean, is that, do we really want to populate virtual worlds with pets that we can't have strong relationships with?
I think, I mean, I'm sort of making a distinction, but I mean, pets sort of a loose analogy. I just mean in terms of the level of kind of organizational complexity. But I think the main distinction that I'm talking about there is that I'm not talking about these entities. I'm not talking about this complexity that you're relating to as potentially another entity in a virtual world. I'm talking about it as potentially the mechanics of the virtual world itself. And that's like another issue, is that because these are not, they're not open-ended complexity like actual reality. They are bounded systems that are perceivably bounded by people. So if you inhabit, you know, when you're an inhabitant of these systems, you actually build a relationship with the entire system that you're inhabiting. I mean, and so, you know, I think it's especially relevant when you're doing something like playing a real-time simulation game, RTS, where you know, for instance, like in StarCraft or something like that, where you're playing against an AI that doesn't have any kind of anthropomorphized representation. It's just a systemic function, you know, that like throws foes at you, and you build a relationship with that, and you begin to perceive the subtleties of the personality of that system. And you actually, even though it starts with no anthropomorphization, you actually project that onto the system, because it's the easy way for your brain to map a system of expectations and responses with a complex system. And so you end up with something like that's almost a model of an artificial intelligence that is different than what the designer built, but it's a more of a relationship than a kind of rule set. So it's less like a pet and more like almost a spirit, you know, some kind of inhabiting, you know, one of the things that's really interesting, I think has a lot to do with the way that Japanese game design works is that there's an animist tradition in Japan where most, you know, in a lot of the, you know, Shinto theology and earlier sort of theologies of Japan, there aren't these gods that are coalesced into anthropomorphized, human-like creatures, but instead they're just ambient spirits that inhabit almost every object in the environment, and therefore you can have a relationship, a spiritual relationship that you know allows for discourse between the human and any object in the environment. And I think that's actually where we're sort of going into that ambient relationship building era with these kind of spiritualized computing objects, to use a Kurzweil weirdness.
Yeah, I mean, it's just as a quick footnote to that. I mean, it's curious to notice that 90% of the robot population lives in Japan. Yeah. You know, where they also don't have the same kind of hang-ups about a little creature talking to me that's not a human as we do.
No, they have hang-ups about immigrants and racial purity instead.
So I actually feel that this line of discussion is really abstract and academic. And what I'm really interested in at the heart of it is, why do avatars even matter, right? There are a lot of panels at this show about avatars and virtual worlds. Why does any of it matter? Why are we even talking about this? And I think that those are all symptomatic of what the underlying trend is. And really the underlying trend is that the cognitive dissonance between people's online and offline selves is dissipating. And what does that mean? That means that, you know, everything that we're doing online is very real to us. And how we represent that could be expressed through avatars, or it doesn't have to be expressed through avatars. Avatars isn't necessarily like the assumptive form that they should take. But on the other hand, avatars do create an interesting condition in the environment, which is now you're all of a sudden, you're moving from a first-person fixed perspective camera view of your environment to a third-person camera view of your environment, which then opens up all these different possibilities for your relationships with other people and the world that you're experiencing online. And I think that's really interesting, because all of a sudden now, you know, if you look at, there have been a lot of academic game studies about what creates immersiveness. It's not necessarily 3D graphics. It's not necessarily virtual world environments. But what it is really well-defined roles, role engagement, you know, how you engage with other people online and what your role in that community is. I mean, that's the number one result that comes up time and time again in terms of defining what an immersive environment is. So what role do avatars play in creating immersiveness and engagement? That's the real question, I think.
Well, and I think it's interesting to hear, Mark, how literally you see your identity in Second Life as a projection of yourself, because it makes it sound like you see it as an art camp that you're going to, and you're making the arts and putting them up, and they reflect on you as an artist as part of your extended gallery, as opposed to somebody who would go there in order to escape who they are and not refashion themselves literally as they envision themselves.
Yeah, and I think that regardless of how you build your avatar, even what you're doing, I think that, Susan, to your point, I think that our avatar represents some part of ourselves. And usually it's like, you know, from a psychology standpoint, it's that hero part where we want to... A lot of people look like Greek gods in Second Life. I think that's part of the reason why.
No, it's true. There's all these studies that show that everyone chooses much more attractive and taller avatars than they really are in real life.
In Second Life, I have facial hair.
Well, I mean, it kind of gives new meaning to the idea of objectification, right? I mean, that's the thing that's the threshold that you go over when you have an avatar, is that you have an other that is a self, and therefore there is a leash there, right? There is a distance that is leashed rather than it being self-similar. So it's not there at that point. Then you've entered into another relationship with yourself. So there's another that's part of that's part of any simulation game you're playing with an avatar, is a negotiation between yourself and the avatar that's representing you. And that's the game that happens before there's any engagement between the avatar and its world, is the engagement between you and the avatar.
Yeah, I had this weird moment where I was sitting on a cliff having a glass of wine with an old friend, and we were watching the sunset. And we were doing it in this architecture that I had made. And I realized that I was in Second Life while I was there talking with this friend. And it was actually a very strong emotional moment. Like, I realized I'm way off the deep end on this.
Well,
it wasn't like just my avatar that was there. It was me. I was like, you know, like, you can't.
No, you were like this. You were like this on the thing. You know what I mean?
But yeah. But that's again the weird thing. Like, from a cognitive standpoint, like, My brain's locked in a black box, and there's signals going in and out of it. That's it. It's that my brain can tell what's out here only through those electric signals. And because I spend a lot of time in 3D worlds, I'm pretty sensitive to what happens there. So I think that I think that on a deep level, there isn't a difference.
I actually, so I really like what Justin's doing in the area of passively multiplayer games, because if you think about it, we all have avatars online today. All our avatars are already all behaving in activities online. We just don't necessarily have a container to put all those experiences in, right? If you know, your 3D avatar in Second Life is such a container, and it's made very clear to you that, you know, there is a container to put those experiences in. But, you know, when you're visiting MySpace or Dogster or any other online community service out there, you do have an avatar, even if it's not immediately apparent to you. Especially as you're moving between these different communities, your avatar stays persistent with you throughout.
Yeah, it's almost like we need a peopleaggregator.net to kind of pull these things together and give us
a... for the question and answer show. I don't even think Mark's even here. Actually, I think Susan's definitely, that's a really good point. And I think that's, you know, in some ways when I say I'm working on data visualizations in social software, that's exactly the shape that I'm hoping to be able to see, is the idea that, you know, we are all already these sets of aggregation that are moving through data sets, you know, and we're leaving, you know, a set of tags and timestamps behind us as we go. And that as we evolve tools that allow us to see that movement more effectively, that's, you know, we'll begin to perceive each other as that, you know, you'll be able to see. I mean, I think there's literacy in the idea that, you know, an avatar is actually a composite object that doesn't, you know, that exists only through we can only perceive it if we're using the right tools that are visualizing complexity.
Well, I there's a guy who works with Mark at Headcase Labs named Paco Zander Nathan, who I got email a couple weeks ago saying he wanted to work on an open ID standard for avatars. And I've always loved toying with this idea. You know, I put a lot of time and energy into my City of Heroes character, and then I wanted to take it to World of Warcraft because my City of Heroes character could fly, and I was going to have to put an awful lot of time and an expansion pack into World of Warcraft before I could ever fly. So if there was a sort of sense of portability and transmutation for these avatars within virtual worlds, I mean, the idea of really making the who you are online clear, you know, starts to collapse context in troublesome ways for people who are guiding experiences or people who are looking for employees who have rich MySpace pages and have hung out with Mark in the early 90s.
Yeah, so my view on avatars is that, you know, for all the academic jargon we could throw around it, I actually think it's probably it's probably the number one most undervalued real estate on the web today. People just aren't paying attention to why avatars are so important. You know, the current metaphor for avatars are things like WeWorld and IMView and things like that, where your avatar is really kind of a fun aesthetic.
Paper doll.
Yeah, sure, star doll. And things that are really aesthetically pleasing. But I think that there's something much deeper going on here, which is if you own that emotional engagement with the user, and that is expressed through an avatar, you are pretty much owning their online experience in all these different forms. And, you know, I see a lack of attention being placed in, you know, creating good avatar services or good avatar products.
Yeah, I mean, like from the skin side, I go around and, you know, most 3D worlds in there, and what people are buying are things like, you know, they're buying clothes, they're buying little wings, they're buying halos, they're buying things like harps, right? And that's or other stuff too. But that's something that seems to me to be pretty important, is that I think that the majority of sales that are going to be happening will be around how do I represent myself? And it's fine for there to be architects actually building the spaces. But that, I think, is going to become really a major. That's going to be where the money is going to be made. Okay, if you want to get pragmatic about it. On the other hand, from like the inside of it, I feel as though I'm looking at a lot of different things that I want to do, and I don't always want to leave my character. Sometimes I want my character to run on his own inside of Second Life, because that way people can maybe come and talk to him. Like, I've got an answering machine, right? It's pretty simple. People call. It's like, hi, I'm not here right now. Please leave a message. Beep. They know that it's not me, but they know that the message will get to me eventually. And there's a level of it's a one-step level of interactivity. But right now what I want to do is I want to kind of smear my avatar out away from me a little bit so that way people can come, they can talk to him, and almost like an answering machine in a way where there's a bit of my personality that's still there.
Would you want them to know whether you were actually there or not?
It would depend. In some cases, yes. That's the thing that I call a clutch, right? And I think that there's going to be a lot of people that are going to have autonomous avatars running non-player characters in virtual worlds. Armies of orcs, say. We set them up to come running down the hill together. There's going to be a couple. They're going to know that if I kill the druid first or if I kill the wizard first, that's going to be how I can get rid of this particular tribe of, you know, people I'm fighting against. Am I making any sense right now? And so then I think you'll at that point want to have something where if it's a non-player character, you can have one person run 50 or 60 characters and then kind of teleport in and out of those bodies as they're in battle, say. A lot of other examples too.
Yeah, I think also it's interesting you were talking about this idea of the clutch and the fact that we may have a multitude of representations that we can decant our focus into at one time, right? So you have a lot of different ways that people are attempting to interact with you, and then depending on where in that sort of field of potential relations you want to focus your energy, you still have
yeah.
You know, a sort of a passive relationship with all of these other discourses that are going on, but then, you know, it's basically the continuous partial attention that's supported by the sort of lighter artificial intelligence you're talking about that would support those things,
sure.
Give them the sort of navigatable voicemail version of your you know, response to their query.
I mean, I think that like our attention and the autonomy of the system are going to always be inversely proportional. So like the more attention I put into it, the less autonomous it's going to be, the more like an avatar.
I'm really excited by services like My Blog Log and Traxor because there are a lot of different ways to describe presence online, right? Having an avatar is one way of creating some sort of 3D relationship with your environment. But I think My Blog Log, for me, really succeeded because it created a sense of social presence in the form of, you know, it kind of made me feel like I had an avatar, even though I don't have really a personified avatar in my normal web browsing experience. And I think it's systems like that that are really interesting in terms of where you think avatars are going in the future. Not necessarily, you know, your avatar as within Second Life, but your avatar as within your embodiment of your normal experiences every day on the web. And again, that goes back to what work that Justin's doing in passively multiplayer gaming.
Yeah, I want to follow people around the internet and describe them and who they are. But Mark, how would you create, I guess that's what you're trying to do, is create a convincing sense of who you are. I got really tripped up trying to describe people based on their web trails. And I can say, you know, Susan likes to read about games and she likes to read about finance. But then extrapolating a sort of rich, interactive, nuanced profile. I mean, it makes a D&D character sheet look rich, right? Because at least the D&D character has strength and charisma and speaks orcish and has the ability to climb ropes or whatever. But all I can say about Susan is that she likes business and games.
But that's the thing that's kind of funny about personalities, is I think that on some level it's our ability to predict what that person's going to do. You and I know each other well enough that we have some sense of predictability with one another. And I think for me, I look at it as it's this thing that I think of as an emotional user interface. And there are choices that we make, specifically in terms of words, that with some kind of predictive analysis, we can begin to generate a personality from. So there's a percentage that I'm going to use an F word, right? Food, fun, family, friends. These important things are all, I use these words frequently, right? And the percentage likelihood that I use a particular word is probably going to have something to do with my personality, right? So you can look at that, and there's like, you know, I'm more likely to talk about HTTP calls than I am transmissions. Now, that ability to predict what I'm talking about is where you can begin to generate a personality. I think that you can then, through what you're doing, look at, what's Big Ed's email look like? And then begin to build a personality that has some element of predictability. Because I don't think that the Turing test is going to work. I don't think it's going to be passed. It's too generalized. We tell who a human being is by that individual personality, not by humanness, right? So for me, what you're doing is super important because you're saying, let's really look at the individual personality that's there. Does that make sense?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was actually just having a conversation last night about this, about the... There are certain ways that you can describe in the turning point, the tipping point. Malcolm Gladwell describes a couple of personality types, and one of which is the connector, which is something I've been accused of being. And I think one of the things that the connector personality type is
the connector
is modeling other people, and that's because what you can do then is you maintain basically an avatar of that person that's with you all the time. You have a model of what they might say about something, and then you meet someone else who has a similar domain understanding, and you realize, because you can model this other person who's not there in the conversation with this person, you can say these people would have a lot of things in common. So I think there are a lot of social skills that are kind of being built out of this literacy in social networks. There are extending our capability to, understand our relationship with people and understand the context under which that relationship is engaged. Which, one of the things a lot of people talk about OpenID. I'm sure we'll probably get a question about OpenID after this. We go to the audience, one of the things that's interesting about fragmented ID is the fact that then you have a whole bunch of avatars, basically, that are participating in domains that have different dimensionality. I mean, basically, when you're talking about this idea that, you can only model your passively multiplayer people on these things that you can collect, that's true of all of these little micro worlds that we're building for people to transact inside of. So, in Flickr, basically, the domain for sociability is photography. And so you have a set of variables around photography in which people can interact. And so you have a faceted avatar that is the photography avatar. And then you have another avatar that's dealing with a different type of sort of canonized web service object, and that's pivoting around that. And so, you basically then have different ways. You can bring someone, it's almost like some kind of alchemy where you can bring a person who you have a relationship with in one kind of faceted domain into another one and see what kind of transformation happens in the relationship based on that. It's like, okay, we were photo friends and now we're going into the video domain and it's all different. Who knows whether we'll be friends there too. But it probably is the case because there are a lot of the overlapping variability in the way that we've constructed our relationship. But I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah,
so.
Frankly, it's a little frightening. I'm not sure if I want all my business colleagues to know what a griefer I am inside of World of Warcraft.
Totally. No, that's why the fascinating is important. Yeah.
Well, it's funny, Susan, because I was actually just thinking about you. I guess in my head, I picture you as like this huge battle-hardened warrior down there, like coming from the bowels of Quake. So your experience in the tourneys is really interesting. And I think that in some ways, but you're also a jewelry maker. And that's a rich personality there, right? But I also think that in a way, I wonder, looking at the personality that's in different systems, I have like my business personality and then I have, whatever, my like art personality, let's say, or my drunk personality, my sober personality.
Right.
I'm trying to find where do they actually. But there are certainly personalities that we have that we each kind of carry with us at certain points. And we have different roles that we play, frankly. And I guess I'm thinking about the different systems that we're in. And I wonder, Susan, for you, like when you're doing tourney, you probably would see people and you would know this one's going to be hard to deal with, right? Because of the interaction within that space.
Yeah, sure. I would say it is really difficult to reconcile across different domains, which is why I'm interested in how... I don't think it's ever... Let's tie this back to the avatars in our panel. I don't think it's ever the case that we're going to have one avatar that necessarily represents all of us across all these different communities.
Right.
What I do think is we're going to have one container that stores multiple subcontainers of avatars, and each of those subcontainers represents our personality in a particular space. And then the reason why I'm supportive of OpenID is because it allows you to control which of those elements get exposed to which communities. I think, and just from my personal perspective, it is hard to reconcile the different communities because... there are very little of those sets intersect with each other.
And they may be splitting apart more and more, which is why we have to make more of them. As we kind of consolidate our interests as users, we find that they become more rarefied from one another.
Yeah, I have a question relating to MPCs. So we all understand what the we all understand the context of NPCs, non-player characters in an online game, you know, right? They're usually the people that we go to for quests. They have a limited intelligence or a limited scripting language that tells us how we should interact with them. What is the role of NPCs in a web product or a web service that changes how we interact with the web service and changes how we interact with other people in that service?
Well, I think about earlier when Mark was talking about people having sort of specific functions and different sides of their personality, you come to know. I mean, I was just thinking about, I lost my mobile phone yesterday, and I talked to like three Sprint PCS NPCs.
Exactly. And they're so stupid. They're always stupid.
They're sort of limited functionality. Is the nicer way to say.
Yeah, exactly. I know. And they're everywhere, too, like ATMs. You know, whenever you try to book a ticket, they're surrounding us. It's a little unnerving. I wish they'd, yeah.
What, they need better personalities? I wish someone was making a company that gave better personalities to NPCs.
So I think maybe we should wrap it up.
Yeah, have questions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping we'd have like a good 20 minutes for questions. And I have a note here that says, please ask the audience to ask questions from the audience mic.
And we'd like to ask people who ask questions, say your name and your sort of affiliation or URL or something.
Takes the audience hostage here. My name is Steve Grant. My name is Steve Grant. I'm a strategic planner for a company called TDI in Long Beach, California. I do consumer ethnography and interactive account planning for automotive. So that's a big mouthful there. Most of what I've heard over the last 30 minutes or so seems to be new language for some pretty old ideas. You know, there's Whitman's quote from I Think Song of Myself, which is, do I contradict myself? You know, very well, then I contradict myself. I'm large, I contain multitudes. You know, this is an suspension of disbelief that one might have some type of personality shear between one venue in which they perceive, you know, people and others. To what extent, I guess I'm trying to get what the thing I would like to understand from the panel, hear your opinion is, do you feel like this is some type of brave new world of unprecedented terrain for human psychology and the way that we relate to each other, or is it really more ultimately a question of tactics and infrastructure that we're just instantiating essential elements of the human condition, but we're kind of accelerating it through the use of technology?
Yeah, let's go down.
I think it's both. I think in order to change human behavior, you have to first create structures and systems that people are very comfortable in using. So if you think about like what Web 2.0 is, there's so many different ways of describing Web 2.0, and there's all these different terminologies. But really what it is for me is creating systems, creating technology that makes it easy for people to relate to each other in ways that they already feel comfortable with. And in order to change the future or change the future of behavior, you have to first accommodate them and then slightly nudge them in the right direction.
I think there's definitely, I mean, in a way, not to go too far off the abstraction handle, but this is an extension of language, and the fact that already, you know, inhabiting languages change people already, and the fact that we now have all these, you know, the sort of dimensional subdomains that I was talking about before, the fact that you can go into Photo World and live there, means that you can, that, you know, there's a different kind of community that, I mean, community is the thing that produces language. And so, you know, as that sort of spiral continues, then language, you know, as community produces more language, then it turns in on itself and has a new vocabulary. And whether people, you know, there will be a new type of photographic language. I mean, when Flickr first began, well, this is kind of an interesting aside, is that when Flickr first began, we were still using this the client which was built for the game Neverending, which was a Flash client that had a real-time chat component to it. And so initially what was happening with Flickr is that you would bring photos into a chat conversation. And so it was actually a dynamic photographic conversation, which was made for a very different situation. You had what we called a shoebox, which was kind of like the collection of all the photographic resources you had on hand, and you could just kind of drag those into the chat as you were chatting. And so it made for this type of quotation that's very different than, I mean, you know, already there's still a rich type of discourse in the community on Flickr and in other tools that use Flickr photos, but there was something kind of essentially different about the idea that was real time. And I think that that's, you know, in general, this idea of being able to, like, you know, know, pop open the window floating next to your head like the newscaster and sort of, you know, have all of the quotational reference of the stuff that you're talking about, you know, in whatever media format you need right there is essentially makes for a whole different kind of mm-hmm. interaction, you know, and so that's kind of where, in some ways, where we're headed. So it makes for a new type of person, but in using, you know, framed in the same philosophical concerns, you know, of the ages, I guess.
I loved the Whitman quote. It's now been long enough that I kind of forgot your question, but it made me think of this one thing, which is that there's sort of single-player computer games. I think by most game designers, single-player computer games are viewed as a historical anomaly because most games are inherently social. And so there's a designer, Danny Berry, who made Mule, which is a great game, who said no one ever goes to their grave saying, I wish I spent more time with my computer. But now we've reached this era where we've come back out of 20 years of people crouched over their machines alone playing, and we've come out into relating in that space. So I just think it's really interesting. I feel sort of lucky to be a mutant child of this period where I came of age with electronic babysitters who played alone with me, and in the future all of these children are going to be raised playing with each other in these babysitting worlds. And it feels like it's different to me, but I wasn't around when Whitman was around. But I think Whitman would have been right with Susan Wu on the container of subcontainers. That sounds exactly like I Contain Multitudes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I would probably also say that in the short term, it's going to be the latter. In the long term, it'll be the former. In other words, in the short term, it's going to be familiar. And then in the long term, it's probably going to get weirder and weirder. Because I think that as we get more and more characters that are, like, really beginning to articulate new kinds of intelligence, and they've got and they get emotions that we've never understood, and they're arguing we are people because we come from people, and I fall in love with one, and then it tells me how I can raise my kid, then I'm going to be like, this is something new, Mom. You know, so you know, what's the next question?
What I really love about human beings is that the more we hack our software in our brains, the more likely it is that we're going to be hacking our hardware. And I think that's another way to look at what we're doing here with technology. So I don't know, that was abstract to you.
Yeah, no, it's true. And there's again another weird proportion that's happening. We were talking about this story.
Second question.
Yeah, I know.
I'm Laura Gregg. I'm an MFA candidate at Berkeley. So this has been a really interesting discussion for me, so thanks. But I'm curious, especially in light of what you guys have been talking about with, you know, our multifaceted personalities intermingling with these multi-portal avatars, how you guys feel about identity tourism and whether you think it's healthy or harmful.
Maybe you could give a one sentence on identity tourism.
Well, you know, people adopting avatars that are very different from their real or physical person.
Huh. Oh, I think it's awesome.
Yeah.
You guys?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm of two minds about it. I think there's a danger, obviously, in terms of, like, I mean, one of the things we didn't really talk about in this situation is that. One of the metrics of these contexts where all these fragmented personalities are taking place is trust, right? And that's the issue, you know, with identity tourism in a situation where there's a high trust quotient for that world. It's weird because obviously you're maybe creating relationships with people based on something different, you know, than the other person expects. But at the same time, you know, there are also conditions in which that type of role playing is exactly the point. You know, obviously WoW is, you know, you're not gonna, no matter how hard you shop for an avatar in WoW, you're not gonna find one that's like your, you know, actual person. So there's definitely there's a gradient between this escapism and identification. And that's like, and that's where a lot of this the negotiation between the avatar and the self takes place, is in that spectrum.
There's a writer named John Tynes, who I discovered on the plane on the way to Austin, in a book called Second Person, which is a collection of essays about role-playing. And he made a game called Power Kill, which he's trying to posit a difference between what Ben was just saying, escapist versus what he calls engagist media. And so he looks at D&D as a sort of escapist medium, and then he made a game called Power Kill, which is a commentary on that, which is engagist. So I'm going to read about two sentences about that. This engagist metagame posits that Dungeons & Dragons participants are living out their fantasies through real-world psychotic episodes in which they practice robbery and home invasion against ethnic and economic minorities. A violent incursion into an urban ghetto is, to the participants, just another dungeon crawl in which orcs and their money are soon parted.
Yeah, and you know, to answer that specifically, as a longtime D&D player, I love that. I love that because I don't have to take it into the real world. You know, everyone's like, games are so violent. I'm like, not compared to football. You know, not compared to like, you know, other kinds of. So I think it's fantastic that
not
like
compared to apartheid.
Right. There's so few places in which we have room to play and experiment with costs that don't have the same stakes. In other words, like puppies that are playing, they're learning to fight. But they don't have to suffer the same wounds, you know? So I think it's good for us to have a room like that.
Actually, just anecdotally, we were a long time ago in the sort of more naive days of online gaming. I worked on a project called Heat for SegaSoft that was one of the first sort of ways of it. Basically, it was a social network for laddering that you could launch. There was a plugin for Navigator that you could then use to launch Quake, or I guess it was Doom back in the day, and then return results into this laddering system. And as their promotional campaign, these people made up somebody. Evan, do you remember what this guy was called? Dr. Chandragarian or something like that, who is this totally faux cultural psychologist who is I can't even remember what the name of the movement was called. Cyber diversion, right? And so it was this fake social psychologist who was about, you know, was in all the campaigns for Heat that was saying like, you know, take your aggression online. And it was like the whole idea was like, you know, through cyber diversion we'll cleanse the world of all these like, you know, evils of like people having to fight each other because they'll just, you know, launch this plugin in their browser. And it was like, it's strange that here we are. I mean, that was like, you know, an advertising campaign, and now that those are you know, real issues. So it's kind of strange that the world has taken that kind of turn.
Yeah, one quick follow-up. So I really like the idea of identity tourism. It's been proven in many studies that one of the foremost ways by which people become more empathetic is by traveling to physical different environments and immersing themselves in different cultures. And I think identity tourism is one way to do that. But the corollary is that if you look at how avatars are used today in online environments, 90% of our interactions with other avatars is through physical violence. So then the question becomes, how do we create environments where your avatars are engaged in productive and self, you know, in positive reinforcing behavior? So that's all.
A tale in the desert?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're trying to do. Is I think it's a very primitive form of interaction.
You know, quest for the avatar, so. Strangely enough. Yeah, that was that session at GDC about that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Third question.
Hi, I'm Trisha Creekmore from the Discovery Channel, and I'm going to try, hopefully don't pelt me, to bring this sort of really heady philosophical discussion into more of a, you know, what I'm here for, which is how do I adapt this for what Discovery Channel is doing online. And I think, you know, when I go back to my company, I don't get to talk philosophically about identity and avatars. What I have to do is say, what's our social media strategy? And right now,
just to interrupt real quickly, what is the Discovery Channel doing? If you could start by telling us that.
Oh, a lot of things, mostly with video right now. And I think for the last year, there's been a conversation going about social media and what should we do. I mean, right now in social media is where we're really, I think, behind, in that we have forums and people talk, which is, you know, pretty low tech, but it kind of works because those are where the fans, what we're dealing with is fans of our programming. So you want to go and talk about Mythbusters. It's pretty basic. And we do chats with our celebrities. So, but, you know, everyone's talking about what's the next generation of social media for a large company like ours. And so you've got everybody running around going, okay, we're going to buy an island in Second Life. Someone else wants to buy the blogging software, you know, partner so that we can have MySpace and YouTube on Discovery Channel. I mean, these are the kinds of ideas that are flowing around. But based on what you're saying, it's occurring to me that, you know, what we want to do is, you know, we have an emotional connection to our viewers. So people who love Mythbusters love Mythbusters. And they want to, you know, like, I love Guns N' Roses, so I have a shirt. You know, I mean, it's pretty basic. So it seems to me like selling avatar merch sort of to all your various identities.
Yeah, so it's funny to think about selling avatar merch, but then do they just wear that? Can they only wear that T-shirt on the Discovery Channel? That's, I guess, a reason to start hiring, you know, little Second Life piecework craftsman to start making Discovery Channel t-shirts for 25 cents an hour and stuff like that.
We already have IM, you know, you have your little IM thing that has Mythbusters on it. But so then, you know, do I recommend that we, you know, stop all this madness and, you know, let's get involved where everybody is, because everyone's sort of just, like you're talking about, leaving a trail with all their various avatars.
Right, and this is a problem of the container of subcontainers, right? It's like, I may like Mythbusters, but I may not decide it's worth it for me to have a separate avatar for Mythbusters and a separate avatar for, I don't know, whatever surgery show or BattleBots or something like that.
So I'm saying have a Mythbusters, I don't know, avatar, maybe Jamie and Adam, you can buy and be them in Second Life, or, you know, a little t-shirt for your avatar. You know, it just as opposed to sort of the bring them to us, it's go out to them. That's what, based on what I'm hearing here, I'm thinking, but I wanted to know what you're...
Yeah, actually, I think there's a... another way to look at that question is not just avatars within a world like Second Life, but widgets as a form of syndication across the entire web. Right. Today, most widgets are user-generated content type of widgets, right? Usually they're used to describe stuff I'm already doing in other sites or things that I'm already participating in actively. I think there's a huge market for branded widgets, like widgets to describe yourself on your blog in a way that helps reinforce that affiliation for or aspiration for being a Discovery Channel type of person. I think there really is a huge market for that, and I think it's really underexplored today.
No, no. I mean, yeah. I think she actually said it pretty well. I guess I would go more, you know, thinking about the way that one might, you know, move representation outward is definitely bringing fragments of those worlds onto other, you know, pervasive contexts. You know, so bringing widgets out there, bringing, you know, a lot of what people look for are ways of, you know, having a very lightweight view into what's happening to their avatars in various places. You know, so a lot of times people talk about, you know, little mobile indicators of the, you know, sort of the attributes of the character elsewhere and things like that. So it's not so much the things that I think are more that move out and propagate out into the world are not really merch per se, but actually dynamic fragments, you know, are things that people are more interested in because it makes them feel connected, you know, in real time.
And the good news for you is that you have a good brand, so people are going to be more likely to respond to what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'm very useful to you right now, but I just saw a demonstration of the PlayStation Home service last week at the Game Developers Conference, and the head of Sony showed what looked like a very polished and commercialized Second Life, and it was like you turn on your PlayStation 3 and you're basically pushing a shopping cart around and pulling down various video game trinkets. But I think, you know, Sony was basically saying we're gonna make a stab at the definitive virtual mall through your television, and you know, we welcome people to advertise and do promotional goods and things, and I think that'll be a very interesting experimental space to watch build, because you won't have the people running around in giant love-making squirrel costumes. You'll have just a more polished, more you know, commercial-friendly environment.
Yeah, but I would argue that, so just to close out this conversation, I would just argue that most people, it's more effective to push merchandise out to where people are already living rather than forcing them to come to this contained environment like Sony Home and force them to shop there. That's all.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just real fast answer with one sentence. I think first you guys need to figure out what your mission is, then look at the media type you're using. Because not, I mean, if you're going to try and do a print distribution, don't do it in Second Life. You know.
Yeah,
thank you.
Hi, my name is Pat Tufts. I work at MetaWeb in San Francisco. And in a previous life, I worked on recommendation systems for Amazon, trying to figure out users' intent and what they were actually looking for. And when, Justin, we were talking about modeling the user and saying, well, all I know about this user is that they're interested in, you know, finance and games. On a kind of website where you have a limited kind of interaction, like you're just consuming, you know, you effectively are a kind of NPC to that site. You know, your range of things you can do isn't really that great. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if any of you had any insights on what sorts of things might be good ways to look at to model users and understand who they are in an artificial environment, perhaps less constrained than a lot of the environments we have now.
Well, I mean, that's sort of what I was talking about in terms of those the visualization projects. You know, the idea that you could model a state space of somebody's activity in a given artificial environment. You know, you can cast them in. You know, watch sort of their movements through different activities and different resource consumption and resource production and things like that. You can see actually one of the things that's really interesting that's happened recently is a lot of web services have popped up to do data visualization, Swivel and Many Eyes. And a couple of other services that they consume, you know, RSS or other, you know, APIs to do data visualization. The interesting part about that is if you go to Swivel, there's an enormous amount of data on World of Warcraft on Swivel. Like, if you look on it, like, almost all of the charts and graphs are, like, you know, drops from, you know, major bosses in these lands or whatever, and it's, like, this all these breakdowns. And I think people are already sort of beginning to see how that data modeling is helpful. And so people are actually starting to realize that they can aim that at themselves or in that at each other as well.
And maybe the most interesting part is people interacting with each other rather than, you know, people interacting with the shopping cart.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
Yeah.
And I would say Nick Yee out of Stanford actually has some really good ethnographic research on Second Life. And
on World of Warcraft, right? Yeah. Casey's play on. And
yeah, really ethnographic studies that not many other people are doing. Good research out there.
Let's try and get another question in.
Yep.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Phil Garzieri, and I'm retired.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I have a lot of free time, but my hands are injured, and one of the I was really struck by how Mark was watching the sunset in Second Life, and then you made fun of him because he was crouched over his keyboard. So I was wondering what you see as the future of getting rid of the keyboard.
What was the question?
What do you see for getting rid of the keyboard, you said?
Yeah, because it seems to be the keyboard and mousing. That's just not for me.
How about let's get rid of all abstractions, including graphics? No, I'm serious. I mean that seriously. Yeah. I used to be a text-based gamer, and I fall in love in text-based environments, and all of this, to me, is abstraction that can either help or hurt. It doesn't always help.
Are you claiming that text is less of an abstraction than graphics?
I would say that it's. I would say that text-based games to MMOs today are like crack is to cocaine. So.
Right. That's probably a good analogy.
So it's getting rid of the pipes is the question, right?
Right, but there's more work to cook it up and stuff. So I would say that I did a bunch of experiments with alternate interfaces for games. I played StarCraft with a head-based mouse, and I've used foot-based mice for these things, and I've used voiced commands for my computer, and what I get is sore feet, a sore neck, and a sore throat. So I think it's sort of like if these machines have so much capability to absorb our energy and our efforts that probably the best setup is a range of interfaces that you could switch between a lot if you didn't get compulsively fixed on one task that was working well with your interface. I carry a mobile phone that I can type into with a keyboard, and now I have a sore thumb. So I just don't know, other than like taking a deep breath and standing back and you know, taking Advil, I don't know what else to do.
Well, I mean, obviously, I think unless we've all been hiding under a rock, the word "we" comes to mind when you're talking about something like that.
Yeah, so, tennis elbow.
Yeah, well, but I mean, just the idea that gesture. I mean, you know, I think the keyboard is. You know, what this is might be one. I mean, certainly, if you know, Steve Jobs probably isn't right, but if he is, we may. You know, our children may be wondering what buttons are in the future.
Yeah. Yep. All right. That's next question, please. Thank you.
Hi, Andrew Parker, an analyst at Union Square Ventures. I'm really interested in passive web services, so stuff like Last.fm that monitors what you do and, you know, gives you recommendations, oftentimes helps saves time, or like root.net, so I can go and like monitor what I've been looking at. So I'm particularly interested in what you're doing, Justin, with you know, this passive multiplayer gaming. But I'm wondering, you know, in avatar creation, when Penny Arcade was doing a review of Oblivion, you know, the new Elder Scrolls game, they were saying that like half the fun of the game was simply creating your avatar, and it was a very active experience. It was conscious, like, you know, I am choosing to put on this shirt. It's not passive at all. So, you know, how can you keep the fun in gaming while also making avatar creation more passive?
Just to jump in real fast, I think that it's worth noting that I believe most video games are based on avatar creation. It's just that you're developing the personality and the capabilities after you've developed the physical body.
There's a little bit of both. First, you develop the aesthetic layer, and then you go and you level up, and you're developing their sort of personality and strengths. Fable is an interesting example where your look gets altered as you play as well. So I think there are ways that people are experimenting with all those things. Yeah, like Nintendo.
Last one.
It looks like we're going to come in on time on this one. Thank you. What is it?
This kind of ties back to what you're talking about with short leash avatars and then the abstractions of text versus graphics. That do you see games or any applications that use these short leash avatars to represent ourselves tying into other modifications that use like face mapping and voice chat to become almost pixel perfect representations of ourselves? Or do you see people kind of moving away from that into, you know, becoming the walking squirrels in Second Life? You know, do we want something that represents ourselves in the real world or represents aspects of our personality?
Well, I think it's just one thing. The Wii is a perfect example of this, right? Because people are having an enormous amount of fun with an inexpensive machine that has a very simple cartoonish display that's absolutely away from pixel perfect. And I think if you look at the spirit of joy and sort of celebration that surrounds the Nintendo Wii, it's very much different from how people reacted to the PlayStation 1, which is much more like, how good looking, how I'm ridiculously good looking, you know, in this virtual world.
I would say that, so here's one way of answering the question. I'm an investor. If someone were to come to me with an avatar company today, I would be far less inclined to invest in a photorealistic avatar company than I would to be investing in an avatar company that had really a fun aesthetic sense about it.
I think people, I mean, there's also a really, there's a huge, I think a lot of the psychological issues of modern society involve like people's self-image, right? And so I think people are, it's just not fun to have to try and model yourself, because there's always, you know, there's the, you know, once that happens, then whatever the difference is between the way people perceive you and the way people perceive the model that you've made of yourself is telling about you. And I don't think people want to give that part away either. So I mean, you know, I mean, maybe if you do a photorealistic representation and map it onto you, then you have this way. I mean, there probably will be circumstances in potential virtual communities to come where you'll want to have exact representation. But I think for the
maybe
most
family
part,
reunion.
Yeah, but I think most of the time it's going to be either. I mean, there's no real reason why you wouldn't use a non-virtualized communication medium if you were going to have exact representation. You know, why not just have video chat? It's possible, yeah.
Yeah, it's possible. And you know, like, I guess it's been about, like, 14 years now that I have had a really serious gripe that people keep trying to, like, rebuild reality in virtual environments. I'm like, why is it that when you can do anything, you try to build another Menlo Park?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, that's the thing is, I want to see us, like, build new stuff and new imagination and new worlds. I mean, we have all of this amazing potential. Yeah. So to answer your question, I think it's both. Well, I think people are going to do some realistic stuff.
The most productive era. I mean, one of the most interesting eras of painting, for instance, is when it was unleashed by photography, right?
Yeah,
as soon as realism arrived, everyone was like, okay, fine, that's over. Let's do something interesting. You know, and it's like, and that's I think, something that we're still waiting for. You know, and that's actually what the Wii, and in some ways, I think a lot of people that have done game design for a really long time and have been waiting for that moment are that excited about the Wii, because it's just a stake in the ground that's diverging from the galloping full force into the uncanny valley of like representation. There's like there just really isn't, you know, like you go every year to GDC and there's like a new, more weirdly buxom fairy rendered by, you know, NVIDIA like floating over you, and you're like, you know what, I'm so over this. You know, it's like can we do something else now? It's and so it's, you know, it's time to, you know, it's time to move on. And I think that you know, the Wii, that's what part of what is so exciting about it. I mean, there are still, of course, like the power junkies that are people that drive, you know, performance vehicles and want a PS3 that can render as many polygons as possible. But you know, at the same time, there are people that are looking for that kind of abstraction and representation, abstraction away from representation.
Just to finish this up here, I think that there's pretty much unanimous consent. I mean, let's all go out and make interesting avatars that are new and imaginative and new virtual worlds as well. Thank you guys for coming.
Yep.
Appreciate it.